Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Victor, The Final Battle of Ulysses S. Grant, by Dr. Craig Von Buzek, narrated by Dr. Craig Von Buzek. To my son, Aaron, you have been with me every step of the way on this Grant project. Thank you for your creativity, your critiques, your encouragement, and your wisdom. I'm proud of the man and the artist you have become, and excited to see what you will create. Foreword. It is in looking into the past that we can see the future more clearly. The old adage of those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it is rooted deeply in the study of human nature. In the actions and events of the past, we can recognize the best and worst in our nature. Occasionally, a figure will arise during a particularly tumultuous or pivotal moment that stands out among the rest. Someone who captivates and inspires on the merit of their character and accomplishments. This individual may not be the archetype dashing hero or eloquent statesman, but something about their nature highlights the capacity for good and honor in humanity. Reading about such individuals provides an opportunity to better understand and appreciate the human experience. Ulysses S. Grant remains one of the more enigmatic figures in American history. Despite his monumental contributions and accomplishments, his modesty coupled with misinformation has clouded his legacy for generations. The man who fellow General William T. Sherman claimed was a mystery to himself largely avoided writing about his experiences for most of his life. Grant recognized the role of fate in life and resolved that the best one could do is simply fulfill their duty, regardless of the circumstances. Grant's unlikely rise from relative obscurity to become General-in-Chief of the Union Army amidst the American Civil War was not due to fate alone. Grant's leadership traits were showcased clearly as he guided his nation first to military victory, and then to the beginnings of reconciliation and peace. One thing Grant keenly recognized throughout his life was inequality and oppression. He settled on the fact that not only individuals, but also nations could suffer consequences for their transgressions. The cause of the Civil War, he concluded, will have to be attributed to slavery. A man of peace at heart, Grant recognized, as Aristotle said, it is not enough to win a war. It is more important to organize the peace. He knew this peace could not be achieved with inequality and division in the nation, and he worked as president to establish and protect the civil rights of African Americans. One of the greatest African American leaders of the 19th century, Frederick Douglass, eulogized Grant as a man too broad for prejudice, too humane to despise the humblest, too great to be small at any point. In him, the Negro found a protector, the Indian a friend, a vanquished foe, a brother, an imperiled nation, a savior. Although Grant resisted writing about the war, fate intervened in a series of tragic circumstances during his final years, which led him to create one of the finest literary works in American history. Facing financial failure and terminal disease only increased his resolve to complete the book for the sake of his beloved family in a final, inspiring act of devotion. From this reserved, simple man poured forth a powerful narrative of a terrible war that helped define a nation. It is not simply in his words, but also in his actions that we discover the personal character of Grant. Dr. Craig Von Buzek tells this inspiring story in Victor, The Final Battle of Ulysses S. Grant. The well-documented saga of the final year of Grant's life is laid out by the author, providing an opportunity for readers to peer directly into the past and meet a man at his most vulnerable, but also his most valiantly determined. It is a story of tragedy and triumph that remains eminently relatable to us today. Looking past the glory and fame, we see a simple man fulfilling his final duty to his loving family with the same fierce determination and selflessness he devoted to his country decades before. The author weaves into the narrative the vivid scenes of war as though readers are entering the mind of the ailing general as he pens the words from his memory. The two stories, decades apart, intertwine together so well because readers can draw a consistent line that reveals Grant's steadfast, admirable traits. For Grant, as with many veterans of his day, it was imperative not only to accurately remember their struggles and sacrifices, but also to preserve what had been gained. Grant, in writing his memoirs, wanted to give an honest account at a time when a distorted narrative was being offered by Southern authors claiming a righteous lost cause. Grant's friend, author Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, published personal memoirs, and he employed Civil War veterans as salesmen in a final act of loyalty to their ailing commander. In an amazingly noble act of love, Grant completed his book, restored his family's fortune, and secured his final victory. Today, as America continues to grapple with some of the same issues Grant and his contemporaries faced, Dr. von Buzek's work provides a powerful opportunity for reflection on who we were, who we are, and who we can strive to be. The struggle for racial equality, for unity, and for peace still remains, and looking back provides inspiration to continue forward toward a better future. We learn that America owes a great debt to Ulysses S. Grant. His immortal words, "Let us have peace," reach across the years to help guide his beloved nation forward. Ben Kemp, U.S. Grant Cottage Historical Site Operations Manager, Mount McGregor, Wilton, New York. Chapter 1, World Tour, 1878, Cairo, Egypt. Like a sentinel before the pyramids of the pharaohs, the Sphinx stood with its lion's paws outstretched, as if digging into the sands of the Giza desert. In the ancient past, the painted face of a vaunted pharaoh adorned the stone creature, half lion and half man. Then, over thousands of years, the human features of the king slowly vanished, whittled away by blowing sand, the scorching Egyptian sun, and the chisels of vandals. Surrounded by arid desert, the Sphinx once stood on the banks of the Nile, the glimmering white limestone pyramids rising in the background, the first of the ancient wonders of the world. Boats of all sizes and shapes carried pilgrims up a branch of the Nile into the harbor to pay homage at the feet of the Sphinx. On this day, in 1878, a modern pilgrim from a far-off land came to gaze on the wonders of Egypt and stand at the foot of the great Sphinx. He had been honored like a king in his own country, and now he was hailed around the world as a wise, just warrior and a political leader who did his best to bring peace to his people. As he prudently kept his counsel in times of crisis and trial, this man, Ulysses S. Grant, had been dubbed with the same moniker as the ancient statue, the Sphinx. As a result of his strategic vision and leadership, Grant had become the savior of the Union at the head of the federal armies of the United States. He had served first as General-in-Chief of the Army, and then for two terms as President. After nearly two decades of military and public service, he decided to devote time to his beloved family. Because of his son Buck's wise investments on his behalf, Grant had made a small fortune from a silver mine in Nevada. So, when his second presidential term ended, he and his wife Julia decided to see the wonders of the world and visit foreign heads of state along the way. Grant studied people and their customs everywhere he traveled, but he was most interested in the antiquities, so he had come to the land of countless marvels. Seated on a camel, the hot desert sun blazing above, he stared into the weathered, vandalized face of the Sphinx, the human head out of proportion to the lion's body. It looks as if it has kept on thinking through all eternity without talking too much, Grant exclaimed. Perhaps in the mythical creature, Grant saw a reflection of himself. At the U.S. ambassador's request, Ismail the Magnificent, the Khedive of Egypt, had placed a palace in Alexandria at the disposal of Grant and his party. The entourage included General Grant, his wife Julia, their 20-year-old son Jesse, and U.S. Consul General Elbert E. Farman. Chronicling the trip at the request of the general was 37-year-old journalist John Russell Young. During his presidency, Grant had been pleased by the work Young had done for him in Europe. Therefore, Grant asked the reporter to serve as historian and send telegraphic dispatches to the New York Herald describing the journey so readers could follow the general's adventures around the globe. Grant also invited three officers from the Navy's USS Vandalia, which had brought his party to Alexandria at the order of President Rutherford B. Hayes. Farman brought his consulate's majordomo, Hassan, who dressed in Arab style, complete with turban and scimitar. The Khedive, in turn, sent his majordomo, Sammy Bey, to ensure smooth passage for the general's group as they steamed up the Nile. Another vital member of the excursion was Emil Broksh, an official in the Egyptian Antiquities Department, serving as guide. Considered the most distinguished living Egyptian scholar, Broksh knew hieroglyphics as well as he knew his own German language. "What a blank our trip would be without Broksh," Grant declared one day as the party returned from a fascinating ancient ruin. Grant and his party cruised up the Nile in the Khedive's personal yacht, visited Thebes, Abydos, the pyramids, and Memphis. They spent a month exploring ancient tombs, pyramids, and the great temple at Karnak. To guard against the blazing desert sun, Grant covered his head in either a Turkish fez or a pith helmet wrapped in silk. At age 56, the general displayed boundless energy and curiosity. His preferred mode of transport was a camel, though he mounted a donkey when necessary. One of the greatest horsemen in America, Grant easily adapted to the desert beasts. Although Julia had been an accomplished horsewoman in her younger years, she had a difficult time with her Egyptian mounts. "Your ma balances on a donkey very well," Grant wrote to their son Fred, "when she has an Arab on each side to hold her and one to lead the donkey." Grant was enamored with Egyptian history. "I have seen more in Egypt to interest me than in all my other travels," he wrote to Fred. The ancient Egyptian was a cultivated man, but governed soul and body by a ruler. Without a thorough command of all the strength, muscle, and mind of the inhabitants, such structures could never have been built. Without talent, learning, and training, the inscriptions could not have been made. And without mechanical teaching, The large blocks of granite and sandstone could never have been taken from the quarries to their present resting place, nor dressed as they are. Yet he was transfixed by the Sphinx. After allowing him to stare into its face for a long time, Broksh finally rode his camel up next to the general's beast. "Magnificent, isn't it?" Grant simply nodded. Just then, Julia rode up on her donkey, followed by Jesse astride a camel. "Come, my good general," Broksh cried out. "I will take you to the source, the beginning of all things Egyptian." To the source. The party set out on the long ride to the ruins of Abydos. Arriving hot and thirsty, they dismounted and entered the shade within the temple. "We should all take off our hats," said Broksh, "for here is the cradle, the fountainhead of all the civilization of the world." Abydos, which sat amidst the sand and ruins, was the oldest city in Egypt, dating back to Menes, the first of the Egyptian kings, who reigned in the centuries before the Jewish patriarch, Abraham. When asked whether the civilizations of China and India did not claim to antedate Abydos, Broksh answered, "To be sure it did. But in China and India, you have traditions. Here you have monuments. Here, under the sands that we are crunching with our feet, here first flowed forth that civilization which has streamed over the world. Hebrew, Indian, Etruscan, Persian, Roman, Greek, Christian. Whatever form you give it, whatever shape it takes, this is the fountain of it all. Here are the stones on which are written the names of the kings from Menes to Seti I, Broksh retorted dramatically. "Seti built his temple somewhere about 1,400 years before Christ, and like a dutiful king, he wrote the names of his predecessors, 76 in all, beginning with Menes." Broksh read the hieroglyphics on the stone carvings as easily as if he were reading the morning newspaper. "Here is the very stone, beautifully engraved, and thanks to the sand, kept all these centuries as fresh as when the sculptor laid down his chisel. It was only found in 1865 and is perhaps the most valuable of the monuments because it knits up the unraveled threads of Egyptian history and gives you a continuous link from this day to a day beyond that of Moses." Broksh encouraged the group to explore the rest of the city. Julia Grant rode along on her donkey while the rest of the party dispersed in different directions on foot. The general and Young climbed the highest of the sand mounds. When they reached the top, they could see into an excavation 50 feet deep with the remnants of a tomb and countless broken pottery fragments. You could see the strata that age after age had heaped upon the buried city, Young observed. The desert had slowly been creeping over it, and in some of the strata were marks of the Nile. From that height, they could see endless rolling hills of burning sand. As the shrinking eye followed the plain and searched the hills, there was no sign of life, Young recorded. Nothing except perhaps some careering hawk hurrying to the river. I have seen no scene in Egypt more striking than this view from the mounds of Abydos. Broksh then led them to Karnak, and finally to the grand ancient city of Thebes. "I cannot tell you when the Temple of Karnak was built," Young wrote. Broksh places the first building 3,000 years before Christ. "This seems to be a long time, but I wonder if we think how long ago it really was. You will remember reading how Abraham went down to Egypt because of the famine in the land, taking with him Sarah, his wife, who was fair and whom he passed off as his sister. Well, if Abraham on that visit had visited Thebes, he would have seen a part of this very temple of Karnak, and he could have read on its walls the very inscription which Broach translates today, and which would have told him, as it tells us, of the glory of a king who had reigned before him. Pilgrimage to Jerusalem. From Egypt, Ulysses and Julia traveled to the Holy Land with great expectation, only to be disappointed by the barren countryside, a drastic contrast from the fertile land spoken of in the Bible. The utter absence of all civilization, of all trace of human existence, is the fact that meets and oppresses you, Young reported. The hills have been washed bare by centuries of neglect, and terraced slopes that were once rich with all the fruits of Palestine are sterile and abandoned. The valley over which we have ridden strikes the eye of the general as one of the richest he has ever seen, and he makes the observation that the plain of Sharon alone, under good government and tilled by such labor as could be found in America, would raise wheat enough to feed all that portion of the Mediterranean. It is an abandoned land with barrenness written on every hillside. Grant desired to enter Jerusalem during daylight, so the company pressed forward with great vigor. But as they approached the banks of the brook where David found his 5 smooth stones for Goliath, they were met by a large band of cavalry, which included Americans, Jews, Greeks, Armenians, and a representative of the Ottoman Pasha. The American consul, Mr. Wilson, along with the Pasha's lieutenant, rode forward to welcome the general to the holy city. This was a disappointment to Grant, who had hoped to enter the city unrecognized. "We had expected to enter Jerusalem in our quiet, plain way," Young explained. "Pilgrims, really coming to see the holy city, awed by its renowned memories." As usual, Grant's fame preceded him, dashing any hopes of anonymity. The Pasha offered the general his spirited white Arabian horse to ride into the city. The group followed the winding trail up toward Jerusalem, rising 2,500 feet above the sea as they ascended. "We looked down the mountain's dizzy side and saw hill after hill sweeping like billows on toward the sea," Young explained. "We were thinking of the valley below, of events which have stirred the souls of Christian men for centuries as the path of conquering armies of Joshua and David, of Alexander and Vespasian, of Godfrey and Saladin. And here we were coming with banners and armed men, and at our head, riding side by side with the Pasha's Turkish lieutenant, one whose name will live with that of the greatest commanders who ever preceded him over this rocky way. The general passes on with bared head," wrote Young, "for on both sides the assembled multitude do him honor. We see through the mist a mass of domes and towers, and the heart beats quickly, for we know they are the domes and towers of Jerusalem. We pass through a narrow gate that Tancred forced with his crusaders. We pass under the walls of the Tower of David, and the flag that floats from the pole on the consulate tells us that our journey is at an end and that we are within the walls of Jerusalem." Grant was the first American president to visit Jerusalem. During his stay, the general met with a delegation of American Jews who distributed relief to poverty-stricken Hebrews in Palestine. Grant promised to make their plight known to Jewish leaders in the United States. "Our visit to Jerusalem was a very unpleasant one," Grant wrote to Adam Badeau. The roads are bad, and it rained, blew, and snowed all the time. The snow and rain made for a slippery walk up the famed Via Dolorosa. As they set out to see the holy sites, Julia, the granddaughter of a Methodist minister, took the lead. Entering an ornate sanctuary, Julia was moved by a sign at the door. Anyone who will say a prayer for the soul of Pope Pius IX will receive absolution. Julia immediately dropped to her knees in prayer. "You see, young," exclaimed the general, "Mrs. Grant is taking all the chances," meaning every chance to enhance her standing in heaven. Young described the exploration of the holy city in the midst of the snow and rain. "We pass from our hotel on Mount Zion through a narrow, dingy street, paved with jagged cobblestones, rendered smooth by rain and mud. We make our way with difficulty. We stumble and slide rather than walk. We can readily see, as we retrace our way up the Via Dolorosa, that it must have been a rough and weary road to one rent and torn and bleeding and crushed under the cruel burden of the cross. Even to us, free as we are, wayfarers in full possession of our faculties, it is a tedious task to climb the hill of Calvary." From the Holy Land, the group traveled north in the Mediterranean on another U.S. Navy vessel until they reached the Ottoman capital of Istanbul. The Turkish Sultan was excited to show Grant his royal stables, and the general was impressed by the purebred Arabians. The magnanimous Sultan immediately offered two of his stallions as a gift. "These horses, I am told, have their pedigrees kept for 100 or 200 years back and are of the purest blood," Grant wrote a friend. "It may be of some value to breeders in the United States to get some of this blood." He arranged for his new horse to be transported to the recently built stables at his St. Louis farm. On to Berlin. In Berlin, Young accompanied Grant to a meeting with Chancellor Otto von Bismarck at his residence. Grant shocked the staff by arriving not in a carriage, but on foot. "The general saunters in a kind of nonchalant way into the courtyard," Young related. "The sentinels eye him for just an instant, perhaps curiously, and then quickly present arms. Somehow or other, these grim soldiers recognize at once, as the salute is returned, that it comes from a man who is himself a soldier. His visit is expected, it is true, but it was supposed that an ex-president of the United States would have come thundering in a coach and six, accompanied by outriders, and not quietly on foot." "Of all the princes of the earth," Young exclaimed, "this Prince of Bismarck Schönhausen is the most renowned. It is the prince who comes through the opening portals and with both hands extended welcomes General Grant. You cannot help but note that time has borne with a heavy hand on Bismarck within the past few years. The mustache and hair, which but a short time ago were iron gray, are now almost white. There is even some weariness in the gait, a tired look about the face. I am glad to welcome General Grant to Germany," Bismarck said in slow but precise English as he extended his hand to his guest. "There is no incident in my German tour," Grant replied, "more interesting to me than this opportunity of meeting the prince." Bismarck expressed surprise that Grant was only 7 years his junior. "That shows the value of a military life," the chancellor observed. "For here you have the frame of a young man, while I feel like an old one." The general smiled and graciously replied, "I am at that period of life when I could have no higher compliment paid me than that of being called a young man." The two world leaders sauntered into a library with walls of gray marble and simple furnishings, where the prince offered Grant a seat. An open window.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?